excited about this. How many of you guys have been enjoying this Encounter series? There's so many things we can continue to share. I'm really excited about this morning. I know it's cliche to say things like this, but I've got so many things that I want to share. Kind of a it may be the last segment of this series, maybe not. I'm depending on how far I can go this morning. It's this conclusion. You know, we talked about the women, how Jesus made a point to restore women to their proper place, to restore equality, to restore the oppressed back into a place of being received and loved. I wish I had had time to do that last week, but the story of Mary Magdalene is, for me, it's the pinnacle of what Jesus is doing with women. She represents the woman as a whole, and we're going to go through this together this morning. How many of you guys have noticed that John doesn't write the right way? He's not respecting historical account the way they're supposed to respect it. He's sharing things that are out of order. But I have said this before, over and over, John is more interested in the theologically correct approach of what Jesus really did. And so he takes the liberty to share things in a different ways. If you look at John, he's only sharing 7 miracles of Jesus, but he starts his story by, you know, doing this weird thing that we love to see, you know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and was, you know, you remember that? And he's mimicking Genesis. He's doing it on purpose. He's retelling the story from Jesus' perspective. He's taking creation, and he's starting the story again, but this time with Jesus. He's shifting our position on this whole creation story. Whether you are a literalist or not, whether you think Genesis is metaphorical, it doesn't matter for John. John takes the story and says, okay, guys, let's reread the story from Jesus' account and see what happens. And the problem in our reading of scriptures is we love to take a portion of scriptures, just one verse here, and try to develop an idea to properly understand the book of John and any of those books, to be quite honest with you. You have to read the whole book in one setting if you have time. And the reason is this: you would never take the Lord of the Rings and take one chapter or one section of that chapter and read it, and, oh yeah, I remember that story, and then you create a kind of an alternate fake news about it. You know what I mean? So if you read John, he starts with the garden, he starts with creation, and it ends where? In the garden. The moment, the pinnacle for John is, this is creation from God's perspective. Now this is what happens when Jesus steps into his garden. You understand that? So we're going to look at this. Look how important it is to understand Mary Magdalene. She's one of those women. We have some stories, and there's some discrepancies there historically. We think she's a prostitute. That story came in the 5th century. They kind of extrapolated the story of the 7 demons she was delivered. That's what we know about her and some of the things. There's no indication in the text she was a prostitute. What we know about Mary Magdalene is she was one of the 3 or 4 women who stayed with Jesus through the worst season of his life. She's named in the 4 Gospels, which is interesting because there are some accounts that don't make it in the 4 Gospels. Mary Magdalene is one of those women. She was there when Jesus was beat up by the Romans. She was there when he was on the cross crying out. She was there when he breathed his last. She was there when they took his body down. She was there when they wrapped it and put it in the tomb. She was there the whole time. How many of you guys have noticed it's always difficult to stay with somebody who's in pain? We just don't know what to say. And how many of you guys have had friends who have lost loved ones? And it's that awkward moment. You just don't know what to do. So do I call them? And then we try to offer some comfort and answers to their questions and try to, you know, help them through it. But really, we just don't know what to do. And it's really awkward. And looking at somebody who's going through pain makes us really uncomfortable. It is vulnerable. It's unnerving to some degree. It's very uneasy. And so we tend, in our Western mindset, we tend to avoid pain. And only the closest friends or the family would stay around because they don't have a choice. It's his family. What's so funny about this is Jesus walks for 3.5 years with 12 guys, 70 around, and there's a lot of people following Jesus. But all of them but John abandoned him in his worst moment in life, except for those women. Now, you got to understand Mary. She sees the pain, she sees the blood pouring, she sees the anguish, she sees the last breath, his cry for help, and there's nothing she can do. She can't offer water, she can't offer some comfort. All she offers is her own presence. And if for no other reason, if you have to learn something from those women, is this. Your presence matters for people who are in pain. Would you want to be recorded in the scriptures for no other reason than to be there when Jesus needed you the most? You didn't offer a miracle. You didn't heal the sick. You didn't multiply bread. You didn't do anything extravagant. All you did was you were present in the worst time. That's what those women speak up for me. They're the pinnacle of what real relationship looks like. And again, I'm not going Da Vinci Code with Jesus having a special relationship with Mary Magdalene. Some stories came out later on. In what's true is this, is Mary had a special connection with Jesus because she stayed there till the end. Your presence matters. You don't have to offer an answer. You don't have to respond to their question. You don't have to tell them, hey, this is why you're in pain. This is why this thing is happening to you. This is this. Let me explain to you why you're struggling right now. All you need to do is sit down with people and let them know you're present. You're walking with them in their pain. You're going to be there till the end. And it doesn't matter how awkward you are, how painful it makes you feel like, all that matters is you are there for somebody else. It's simple, isn't it? Yet it takes of our own self to make it happen. It's simple, but it's not easy. You guys with me on that? You have other women named there in the story of Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of Jesus, Mary the wife of Clopas, and Salome. You guys remember those names? Weird name, but there's a whole story there with Salome and Mary, the wife of Clopas. We can go into details there, but suffice it to say, it's pretty interesting to me that the three women that stayed with Jesus till the end are named Mary. I don't think it's a coincidence again. You know, it's funny that the man who wrapped Jesus in fine linen and put spices and laid him in his tomb, his name is Joseph. Now, you got to work with me here for a second. There's a Mary and there's a Joseph at the end of his life. See, John is phenomenal the way he writes. And I would encourage you to read the book with an open eye and realize what John is really saying throughout this story. There's a new creation, a new birth coming. That's what he's talking about. He takes the account of the Garden of Eden, this moment where we rebelled and the world, you know, got upside down, and war and pain and struggle and strife and oppression and dislike and murder and all those things starts happening. As if the garden is a wasteland. And we've talked about that last week. You know, it's as if what God had created had become so wasted and so lost that the only reason we can really take care of it right now is to destroy everything and start over. Now, you were asking why is it not possible for Christians to take care of the earth and be involved in the environment. There's one reason for that, and it's very clear. It's because we have been taught a theology of escape. Where we think this rapture is coming, so who cares about the earth? It's coming at any moment, any time. So we might as well waste the energy, waste this earth, because God is about to create something new. Destroy this with fire, create something new. It is not accurate. And we've talked about that a couple years ago. I'd be glad to meet with you if you need help through this. But the reality is this, God has never given up on the earth. When he created everything, he says, let this be blessed. He blessed it. The blessing came before the curse, and it's got to be our point of origin. You understand that? We can't start with the curse and say, okay, well, now we have to make things right. We have to start with the blessing. You get that? See, what Jesus does in this garden is the last word is not our rebellion. We didn't destroy this whole thing because we rebelled, and now God has to undo everything and redo everything. No, he's now involving himself in this creation as a man. And he's restoring this earth because something restored has much more value than something new. Take an old car that you bought, first Ford that came out, can't remember the date, but if you have a historian here, you would know. Take a car like this and restore it to its original state. How much more valuable this car would be today? Let's draw some comparison. You're all right with that? And then I want to go into this Mary situation. John sets the tone. There's a garden. We rebelled. There's a mess. And then he ends the story with a seed who's laid in a garden tomb. And there's a woman there. Now talk about full restoration. You see, Eve in the story in Genesis, it's kind of a side note, to be honest with you. You know, God talks to the man. He makes things happen with man. He talks to Adam. All this time you have this, and then the woman is a side note. It's a sidekick of the story. Up until the fall. And now God addresses the woman. Why did you do this? And then you have this attitude there. And it's as if, and if you, I got into a pretty interesting debate online about women in ministry and stuff. And staunch Calvinists would keep women away because they have sinned. They are the cause of the fall. And they bring those things up, and it's shocking to me. Because, it takes two. But what's interesting is the moment they fell, man had this twisted idea of blame shifting. It wasn't me. It's what you gave me. And we always tend to put the blame on something else, someone else, to avoid the responsibility. So you know, in the story, it's kind of there, but it's not. The woman is kind of a side note. And she's the cause of the fall. She's the cause of the pain that we're experiencing. And as it is usual for Jesus, he takes this whole story around in John 20. And now, the first person he talks to is what? A woman. Now, it doesn't matter what Eve did then. What matters is what I do with it now. And I'm going to take this and I'm going to restore. And she is fully restored and fully loved and fully known. Even though it may have come through the woman who made this happen, the fall and whatever. Even though she may have been tricked. The reality is this. It doesn't matter for Jesus what you did, what happened before, how much sin you have, how much mess you've been in, how much distortion, how much pain you've been in. When Jesus steps into your garden, he makes all things new. And he takes this woman who, again, if you read the context of the story, if you read the cultural aspect, women had no right, they had no voice, they were not received in any testimony in a court of law. Their testimonies were invalid. And yet Jesus chooses that vessel of a woman who had seven demons cast out of her, who is a sinner, we know that, she's a notorious sinner. He takes that woman to be the first apostle to the apostles, announcing the resurrection story. Think about that. So when you read John, you realize what Jesus really is doing is restoring the rightful place of a woman. That she's not a side note. She's not on the sideline. She's not the cause of pain. She's not somebody we need to, you know, keep away. She's somebody who is so in being loved by the Lord. And she's now fully loved and fully known, no matter what happened in the past. Oh my God. And she is so involved in... She's the one who saw the pain like no other before. She's the one who experienced the fullness of God. Not just the miracles, not just the multiplication of bread, not all the things Jesus did, not the great teaching. She was there in his full humanity when he's dying on the cross. And she's there when he's laid in the tomb. Don't you think the resurrection means something completely different for Mary than it means for all the disciples who gave up on him? And of all the people, she's the only one who saw him as the gardener. Do you see where we're going with that? So the garden is being restored. It's the garden revisited. It's, your rebellion was not strong enough for the power of his resurrection. He has the last word, not you. He will always have the last word. He will never be turned off by your crap. It's okay to say that. Just make sure. It will never be a turn off that you gave up on him. Think about that. The garden is being restored. A woman who was a notorious sinner became the voice of the apostle. She became the voice of resurrection. This Mary, who was not supposed to be a vessel of the good news, has now become the vessel. And isn't it like God to use broken people to point us back to Jesus? Isn't that God to take somebody who's so broken, who's so distraught, who's so sinful, to take that, reveals himself to her and send her away to announce to the disciples that he's resurrected? Isn't that like God to use broken things to speak his kingdom? So we could stop here, but I've got plenty more and I won't stop. If there was a point to be made right here and we could transition, be this. It doesn't matter what you've done. Really, it doesn't. It doesn't matter how messed up your life is now. It doesn't matter how unorganized and chaotic it is. It doesn't matter if your emotional state is in turmoil. It doesn't matter, because God does his best work in chaos. See, this, remember what happened in creation? What happened in the creation story? The earth was void and formless. What happened next? What happened? The Spirit of God hovered over this mess. He's hovering over this mess. Now, you got to come with me, because John is making this connection there. He's hovering over this mess. Now, what happened when the Spirit of God hovered over Mary? Come on now. She conceived. Your garden, your life, your emotional state, your spiritual state, your physical state may be a mess, but when the Spirit of God hovers over you, your mess becomes the greatest creation story ever written. Do you see that? He's not afraid of your manure. He's not afraid of your mess. He really isn't. What Jesus does is this. Not only he restores the woman, but he restores this garden idea. And he's saying, I'm the gardener. I will use your mess. And I will fertilize your ground. And I will bring those seeds back out. And I will cause you to bear fruit. Because I am not done. I did not give up on the garden project. All this time I was around, you didn't see me working in you. I was there, tilling the ground, making things work for you. When you gave up on me, I was still going around planting seeds and hoping things would come up. I was still working and toiling and being engaged and putting my hands in your mess. I was still involved in your life at every turn, even though all you saw was dirt. I was there. He's never done with the garden. He's never done with you. He will never let rebellion be the last word. And the story of the woman restored for me is the story of all the oppressed people to be restored as well. Whether it's an ethnic group or it's a gender or it's anything, He will always restore things to their right places. Well, how come this world is a mess? How come we're still, you know, still dealing with things? The reality is this: when Jesus stands in front of Mary in this garden, it's the first day of creation. It is the first day of creation. The Sabbath ended and Jesus appeared. The first day of His new creation. There's still many days left. Because we're not talking 24 hours here. It is the first day. And He's now using us as His workers in this garden. And He's showing us how things can grow. Showing us how things can be done. You guys are right with that? Let's go to something that's pretty profound. I'm going to need two angels. A Mary and a Jesus. Because I need to highlight something here. Who wants to be two angels? I need a Mary. Nicole, you want to be Mary? I'm going to need a gardener. Who wants to be the gardener? So let me read the story and then we'll walk through this together, all right? John 20, verse... Now on the first day, we'll start verse 1. First day of the week, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb early while it was still dark and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. Then she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved. We know who that is because John writes the book. And he said to them, "They have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid Him." Peter therefore went out and the other disciple and were going to the tomb. So they both ran together, and the other disciple outran Peter. We know who is that is. It's John. He likes to talk about himself in the third person. And came to the tomb first, and he, stooping down and looking in, saw the linen cloth lying there, yet it did not go in. Then Simon Peter came, following him, and went into the tomb, and he saw the linen clothing lying there, and the handkerchief that had been around his head, not lying with the linen cloth, but folded together in a place by itself. Then the other disciple who came to the tomb first went in also, and he saw and believed. It's a weird verse. For as yet they did not know the scripture, that He must rise again from the dead. Then the disciple went away again to their own home. So who's left at the tomb now? Right now only Mary. So Mary, won't you come here? Now Mary stood outside by the tomb weeping. She's in distress. She's crying. You can imagine the turmoil. You know, it's not enough for her to hear about the resurrection. She wants to see it. She wants to see the Lord that she loves so much. She is not satisfied with just the news. She wants to see Him. She wants to hold Him. She wants to hug. So she's here and she says, she wept and stooped down and looked into the tomb. And she saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and the other at the feet, where the body of Jesus was. So you guys are sitting on the table there. And actually, to do this right, you're going to have to stand right here. So you're going to have to... I'm doing this because I want you to see something very visual that we miss in this in the text. So she's stooping and she's looking at the angels inside. Something that Peter and John didn't see, by the way. Correct? Same story. It hasn't changed. They went home. She stayed. Look at this. Verse 13. Then they said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And she said, "Because they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid Him." Now, when she said this, she turned around, saw Jesus standing there, and did not know that it was Jesus. By the way, side note, when Jesus died, He was fully naked, fully exposed. He's wrapped in linen cloth, and the cloth are in the tomb. Some people speculate that Jesus went into the garden house to dress himself to present. I mean, it's speculation, it's an opinion, it's very interesting because logically there's no indication there are clothes there. Anyway, he's dressed. She would have been shocked otherwise. Now, when she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there and did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" Same question the angels ask. "Whom are you seeking?" Now, we know it's Jesus talking, correct? We know Jesus knows everything, correct? He decides to call her woman and not straight away Mary. "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" Now, watch this. She, supposing him to be the gardener, said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." Now, I want you to act this. She turned and said to him, you don't see it. So she's seeing those angels, they're talking to her. She turns away to look at Jesus. Jesus says, "Woman, why are you crying? Why?" You know, and then he says, "Mary." And it says she turned. How many times can you turn? How many times can you turn? Now, I think what John is implying here is there's a turning and there's a turning. There's a turning of her heart. The moment she heard her name, it wasn't enough just to see him as the gardener. The moment she saw him and he called her name, her heart leaped and she turned. It wasn't a physical turn. It was an emotional, a spiritual, she turned. The word would be repentance to some degree. See, it's not possible to turn twice. It's not like she was talking to the gardener, turned back to the angels, and then he called her and turned away. The reason we know this is because John is writing the story, correct? But John isn't there anymore. He's retelling the story from a theological point of view. There's a turning in her heart when she realizes who he really is. And why is this important? It's one thing to turn creation around. It's another to turn their hearts to God. You get that? There's a full restoration, but there's still an invitation for us to turn with him. It's not enough to just restore the earth. We need to turn our hearts to him. When we hear him for who he is, when we see him for who he is, it will cause our hearts to turn to him. Is it possible to see Jesus and not realize it's Jesus? We've done that in our lives, in our religious walk with the Lord. We've followed the Lord and somehow he appears and it causes all our theological standings to be challenged. And we're like, oh my gosh, it was Jesus all along. You see, we always expect a great miracle to force us to believe. We always expect the earth shattering, the thundering, the lightning, and the amazing miracle to kind of force our mind, okay, this is real, I can believe. But the greatest miracle after the resurrection is not the display of power. It's the revelation of the true nature of Jesus. Are you with me? You see, she saw Jesus, but then when he called her, she saw Jesus. What does it say about our doubt? You know, had Mary been in our current church model, we would have said she's an unbeliever. Why could she not believe? She's so a woman of little faith. She should have known because the tomb is empty, because of the scriptures, he was resurrected. Why did she stay there and wanted to see him, wanted a sign? You get that? Jesus is never afraid of your doubt in your walk of faith. He isn't put up by your lack of display of faith. He sees this as an invitation to encounter him all over again. In this walk of life, it's okay to doubt in your faith. There's no shame in that. Think of the two disciples on the road to Emmaus, Luke 24, one of my favorite stories. Jesus is dead. They followed him for 3 years. We don't really know, but we assume they're part of the crowd that followed Jesus. He is dead. He told them many times, I will rise again, and in the third day. But they gave up and they left the city of Jerusalem in distress, completely broken, completely confused, because all the things they had followed now had vanished, were done. It was on this cross dying, and they, no hope, and they're walking away. We would have said to those disciples today, you should have kept an expectant faith. You should have stayed in Jerusalem. We would have questioned their motive. We would have said, well, those are not good Christians, because they didn't display this amazingness of faith. They should have stayed. Can't trust them in the kingdom of God because their wobbly faith is a problem. And yet Jesus shows up on their walk of confusion. He shows up there and walks with them and asks questions. So, what's going on, guys? What's up? And they're like, don't you know what just happened? Have you not heard? If anybody has heard, it would be him, right? Have you not heard what they've done to him? And now he's dead? We put our faith in this Jesus, we put our faith in this Messiah, and it's ended, it's done. So we have nowhere to go, so we're leaving. And Jesus calmly, he's not rebuking them. He said, okay, let me show you where this Jesus is in the scriptures. Starting with Moses and the prophet, let me show you where it's pointing to him. And they're amazed. They're amazed. Wow, you know all those things? And you don't even know this thing happened in Jerusalem? It's amazing. Hey, we're about to stay here for the night. Would you mind staying with us? And Jesus does. And he sits down with them. He takes the bread. And as he's breaking bread of communion, their eyes open. He disappears. He's got this thing going on about disappearing when we finally pray handed him. Yeah? It's like the lion in the Chronicles of Narnia. Aslan is not a tame lion. And they're like, oh, it's him. Did not our hearts burn? And you see, he's offering himself once again in their doubt, in their struggle, in their fear, in their wobbly faith. He's offering himself up and he's saying, this is who I am. This is who I am. I am a God who's more interested in communion and staying with you and eating with you than in doing all the great things. Then there's this other story. So now we have Mary Magdalene, who's showing signs of doubt because she's wanting to see the resurrected body. And we have the two disciples. And we have Jesus shows up in John 21. He shows up to all the disciples. And they have this conversation. And they're, like, oh, they're wild. He walks through the door. He eats with them. And he drinks with them. But Thomas wasn't there. Thomas wasn't part of the 12 at the time. So Jesus again vanishes, and Thomas comes in the story, and they tell him, hey, we've seen the Lord, and he's resurrected, and this we did this, and we ate, and we drank. It was amazing. And Thomas, we've labeled him doubting Thomas, like, unless I touch his side, and I put my hands in the holes of his hand, I will not believe. That's really what he's saying. Now, in our current model of church, we would have accused Thomas of what? Unbelief. He's not fit for leadership. He has no faith. You're supposed to stand on the word. Isn't that true? Is Jesus put up by Thomas's attitude? No, he makes a special trip later on, 8 days later, just for Thomas. Now think about that. The kindness of God. Thomas, I know you have this struggle in your faith. I know you're wobbly right now because you aren't sure things are right and it's really what's happening and I'm really the Messiah. You're not sure. I'm really resurrected. I'm coming to visit you just to show you my wound. Just for you. No shame. He makes this statement. It's great to believe if you don't see. But even when you're not in this place of mind, I can still come and visit you. You get that? No judgment, no shame, no guilt. And we could go on of all those visits. One more, just one more. Peter. Peter is known to deny Jesus, correct? I will never deny you. I will stay for you. I will kill for you. I will die for you. Isn't that one of the disciples? Oh, gosh. No, I wasn't part of those guys. And, you know, he denies Jesus three times. Now, you can imagine the remorse, the turmoil in his heart after having done that. The betrayal. Resurrection happened. They saw him. Peter is so undone with how he approached the Lord and what he did to him, how he treated God with disrespect and how he gave up on him, that he goes back to fishing. And he goes to fishing with the disciples. There's this man standing on the shore. And they fished all night. They caught nothing. And this stranger on the seashore said, "Hey guys, why don't you throw your net on the other side?" Which was a, again, look at the story of John. It is the exact same thing Jesus said to them when he chose them to be his followers. Cast your net on the other side. And they experience this amazing miracle. So they do, and they catch a bunch of fish. And Peter realized, oh my gosh, it's the Lord. Right? What does he do? He puts his clothes on. Now, who would put their clothes on to swim in the water? Who would do that? He was trying to cover himself of the shame and the guilt of denying the Lord. And then he jumps in the water and swims. And what does Jesus do? He restores Peter three times. "Peter, do you love me?" And we can develop this whole story. There's so many amazing things here. But the point is this. Jesus was not afraid, put up, ashamed of the denial of Peter. Even through this, Jesus came and restored Peter to its fullest. So if anything you retain today is this, when Jesus steps into your garden, he will fully restore your life. He will fully restore your garden. He will fully restore your relationship if you let him. And the greatest miracle of all is not the earth shattering, is not the earth trembling, it's not the lightning and all those things, which we saw that in Exodus when he shows up to them, because that didn't do it for them. The greatest miracle is having our eyes open for who Jesus really is for us, that he is interested in us, he is happy to spend time with us. He is happy to come and help in our wobbly faith. He is happy to walk with us in our shame and guilt and turn us away to those things and turn our hearts back to him. Are you okay with that? Why don't you guys stand up? We'll take communion. And I'm going to pray for you guys and then we'll step into communion. You can share communion with people like we love doing, because the table is way more important than the temple. And just like Mary Magdalene had this amazing opportunity to see you for who you really are. I'm asking you, Lord, that you would open our eyes to see you. That you've been on our journey all along. You never gave up on us. You never judged us. You never were ashamed of us. Never put guilt on us when we stepped away, when we gave up on this walk of life, of faith, of Christianity. When the Jesus they presented to us was not the Jesus we hoped for, and we had to walk away. Lord, I'm asking you, just like the disciples on this road to Emmaus, you would let us see who you are in this breaking of bread. Lord, I'm asking you that whatever situation we faced in life up until this moment, what we would call manure of life, what people have done, what we've done to ourselves, Lord, I'm asking you to use this as fertilizer, because you're the gardener and you can turn this waste land into a beautiful garden.